Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and I'm joined here with Lahav Harkov. And today, Lahav, in this week's podcast, I want to talk, or at least begin, talking about Artyom Dolgopiat. Artyom, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, probably not the best way, won a gold medal this week. Huge for the state of Israel. History for the state of Israel. Only the second time in the history of the state of Israel that an Olympian athlete on behalf of the state has won a gold medal. We've had bronze, we've had silver, but gold is huge. And, you know, I don't know if this is what you're about to say, but it is a core sport. It's like, you know, judo is great and taekwondo is great and sailing is great. But this is gymnastics, right? That's a big deal. That's one of the core disciplines of and sports of the Olympics, right?
Yeah. What I was going to say is, it's the first gold medal since 2004, so it's a really long time. But perhaps by the time we record this, we have a chance for one other gold, which is also in gymnastics, which is Linoy Ashram in
rhythmic. Linoy Ashram. Correct.
Right.
Correct.
So I'm excited for that too. But
and there still is a small chance. That baseball pulls off something, but not looking.
They can't get a gold, though.
No, definitely not
gold. At this point, they could only get bronze.
Only get a bronze, but not looking too good. But why do I want to talk about Artyom? Is, first of all, very impressive, right? I mean, you know, really...
A beautiful routine.
Beautiful routine. I it was funny, and I don't want to, you know, I guess I can say this because I am Jewish myself, but as I'm watching him on TV performing his routine, and I'm seeing him jump and somersault and do these flips, and I'm thinking to myself... Okay, how is this guy Jewish? You know, Jewish men don't jump that way. Remember, there's a movie, maybe you remember back a long time ago when I was a teenager, White Men Can't Jump,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
With Woody Harrelson and Wesley Snipes. So I think they could make a movie, you know, Jewish men don't jump, especially not the way Artyom did. But I said that jokingly, not knowing his background, but turns out that according to Jewish halacha or Orthodox halacha, Artyom is not Jewish. His mother is not Jewish. His father is. And that's how he was allowed and his family came to Israel in the mid-90s, I guess it was, or 2000s, early 2000s. He came here as a 14-year-old or 12-year-old, sorry, to and under the law of return because the father is Jewish. Later, his mother, even though she's not Jewish, but his mother speaking like a Jewish mother on radio in Israel said, my son can't get married to his girlfriend, right? Because according to Israeli law, we don't have separation of religion and state. Someone who is not considered a halachic Jew cannot be married in the state of Israel. This is absurd. So we can all applaud. And, you know, it was beautiful to see Naftali Bennett interrupt a cabinet meeting and have all the ministers applaud Artyom when he put him on the phone speaker to congratulate him on the gold medal. But those same ministers are not going to let this guy get married. I mean, this is just ridiculous.
So first of all, there are a couple of funny things that I have to say, which is also, it's not just his non-Jewish mother acting like a Jewish mother. It's also his father who, you know, after he won the gold, he said, yeah, he won the gold, but he could have done better.
Yes, yeah, that was great.
Which was hilarious. Somebody tweeted like the most Ashkenazi comment any parent has ever made. But and the other thing that made me laugh was that when Artyom himself was asked about the marriage thing, he was like, I don't want to talk about marriage, which makes me wonder if he's even looking to get married. You know, this could be his mother's way of pressuring him.
Right.
But on the more serious level.
Well, by making it a national headline about his son getting married.
Right. The whole country's talking about it. And the interesting thing, though, is that it's not even really a halachic issue because he's not halachically Jewish and his girlfriend's not halachically Jewish either. I'm not sure about her exact family background, but I read in our sister publication, Ma'ariv, that she's not actually Jewish either. The crazy thing in Israel is that even though there is, you know, halakha doesn't play into it when you have two people who are not considered Jewish getting married, except that Israel, civil marriage just doesn't exist
in Israel.
Does not,
right. To get married in Israel, you have to go through a religious institution. So if you're Jewish, it's the rabbinate. If you're Christian, it's the church. And if you're Muslim, it's the Islamic authorities, right? There's no other recourse except for people who go to Cyprus or travel somewhere else and do a civil marriage, which is insane that a democracy... that Israel wants to be, we are, right, does not provide the basic right to be getting married. And we've probably spoken about this before, right? I'm sure we have. We've all written about this as well, but this has got to change.
Yeah, I mean, and you look at it and you're like, why does the Rabbanu care if two people that it views as non-Jewish get married? And I think the answer is that, and we see this in the issue of Kashrut too, that the Rabbanu doesn't want any competition. They're a monopoly, and they're supported by the ultra-Orthodox parties, which are currently not in the coalition, so this is hope for the change in the monopoly situation. But they oppose anything that could remotely threaten their monopoly, even in a situation where they shouldn't be involved in this person's marriage at all.
Especially, like, as you said, in the case here where it seems that both are not Jewish. But, what I want to connect that with what we saw play out in the Knesset on Monday night, right? So Naftali Bennett takes the podium. He's the prime minister. He's, of course, shouted and attacked. We saw that in his inaugural speech when the government was sworn in now just over a month ago, right? Something like that. He's attacked and attacked and attacked. And he's talking about the budget and how he had this cute line that they were able to get done in 36 hours, what the previous government was able to do in 36 months, right? Which is past the budget. Israel hasn't had a budget in 3 years. But he comes under ferocious attack from the Haredi parties. That's Shas, the ultra-Orthodox parties, Shas and the United Torah Judaism. I saw Moshe Gafni, the longtime veteran lawmaker from the UTJ, longtime head of the Finance Committee. He was evicted from the plenum. Aryeh Deri, right, the chairman of Shas, who you know much better than I do, but I've never seen him jump up like that and yelling and with such anger toward a prime minister in that way. So my question to you is twofold, because you're a veteran Knesset reporter, watcher, observer. So two things. One is, maybe this is actually a unique opportunity for Bennett. They hate him already, right? If he was holding out on religious reforms because he thought maybe the ultra-Orthodox parties would join his government, then, okay, that doesn't look like it's going to happen. So go ahead, create civil marriage, you know, more reforms, do more things. And number two is, what has got them so upset? They've been out of the government before, and they've never been this angry. So what is this?
Well, I want to remind you, last time Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid were in the coalition together, Netanyahu was prime minister, but they passed a law that would require a lot more Haredi young men to enlist in the army. And the Haredim were extremely angry then, too. Knesset member Porush, who's still in the Knesset now, shackled himself to the podium in the right. Knesset, and I think he was fined for repairing it. Although I might be confusing it with when Ahmed Tibi poured water and broke a microphone. But
both beautiful moments.
Right, there are a lot of stunts. But Deri himself, he tends to usually use the tactic of crying more than shouting and being angry. So this was different for him.
Sometimes he cries with the help of an onion. We saw right. that political ad campaign, right? That he did.
Right. Well, and then the behind the scenes video leaked that they cut onions so that he would cry. What they're reacting to is that there are several policies in this government that are going to impact the Haredi community. Interestingly, the enlistment in the IDF has been set aside for the moment. And anyway, those laws were reversed the minute the Haredim got back into government, as were laws requiring Haredi schools to teach the core curriculum. God forbid that they learn math and science after sixth grade or whatever. But the new policies include not subsidizing daycare if both parents don't work.
Right. And in a lot of these families, it's important to point out, the woman works, the father right. or husband spends his time in Kollel, advanced yeshiva, and he does not work.
Right. So in the Haredi community, they have a higher rate of women working than in the broader population of Israel, but the rate of men working is much, much lower. So this is going to cost Haredi families, at minimum, Haredi families who have small children, at minimum an extra 1,000 shekels a year, maybe even more if they have multiple kids. So that's the big one. There are other things that Lieberman's doing that are supposed to, taxes that he's put out there are supposed to change people's behavior, supposedly, which are actually behaviors that a lot of Haredim have, which using disposable plates and cutlery and things like that, which in Haredi...
Plasticware.
Right, plasticware, yeah. So it's very, very common in the Haredi community on Shabbat. They have very large families. And also,
who wants to wash so many dishes?
And so. I think they wouldn't wash dishes in the middle of Shabbat.
Okay, so that's why they use the disposable. Got it. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
I just thought it was because they didn't want to wash the dishes.
Probably a little of both.
Right, okay.
But if you go into Haredi neighborhoods, like, they have, like, emporiums of plasticware. Like, the huge stores. And the other thing, actually, is sugary drinks that probably due to successful advertising campaigns, having like Coke or Pepsi at your table is considered like almost like a requirement on Shabbat for a lot of Haredi families. It's extremely common. And those are two things that we're going to have a tax on, sugary drinks and plastic. Obviously, those are not exclusive to Haredim, but I think it does hit them all pretty hard.
Weren't they also talking about a tax on diet drinks like Diet Coke, Coke Zero?
Yeah, well, so that's, I mean,
I like Coke Zero.
I drink Diet Coke.
So are we gonna have to start paying a little extra? But that's not, we don't have the sugar there.
I could tell you because my father-in-law has for years been trying to get me to stop drinking Diet Coke. Apparently, even though it's not actual sugar, it triggers a response in your body, like an insulin response that is the same as drinking sugar. So it's still really bad for you.
I've heard this before, and also for bone density and other things.
Yeah.
Okay. I still need my Coke Zero.
And so does Ayala Chaked. She was the one who brought it up.
So you think they're really upset about the budget. That's where this is coming from. I mean, that's where Aryeh Deri is standing up and calling him, you're a little liar at the prime minister. I mean, I've never seen him that angry.
Yeah. And look, I mean, people can probably find examples, but I don't generally think that Aryeh Deri is a name caller, even though some of the rabbis who are behind Shas are definitely name callers and have called Bennett all kinds of nasty things over the years, including Rav Avadya Yosef himself. But Deri is less of a name caller, so it was a big thing. I think also what they're trying to do with this budget is to not come out and say, oh, these are anti-Haredi things. But the daycare one, I think, really, really hits Haredi families hard. Mm-hmm. There are other things in this budget that are difficult too for underprivileged families in general, and you know, poverty is very high among Haredim and also in the Arab sector. First of all, there's going to be the discount on public transportation for people who have a Rav-Kav, which is like a reusable bus pass that you could like refill in machines and stuff. You used to get a discount if you filled 100 shekels, you would get like 120 shekels worth of rides. That's going to be canceled. And so I think that will cost a lot of people. If you're under 18 or if you're a senior citizen, then your discount stays, but the other ones don't. Which you would think they want to encourage people to use public transportation. This is not the way to do it. And in fact, they're going to have a fee for people entering Tel Aviv with cars.
Right, I saw that.
So you're going to make it expensive, more expensive to go into Tel Aviv with a car and more expensive to go into Tel Aviv with a bus. So like, what do they want?
Basically, don't go to Tel Aviv anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other thing is that you're going to have to pay a copay to go to specialists. It's only 20 shekels, which is not a lot. And you could avoid it if you get a referral. But there are a lot of things that are being categorized as specialists, which are just like completely standard for people, including a gynecologist, which, you know, basically every adult woman should be going every single year of her life. So it's like you have to pay a tax for being a woman. But, you know, others, ear, nose, throat, like these are very basic things. And I think poor people, people with many children, people who don't speak the Hebrew language well, that extra step of needing a referral and the extra time they have to wait is going to be costly.
Two things. A, it's costly and it could make people, it could mean less money in people's pockets, but also lead people to say, you know what, I don't need to see a gynecologist this year, or that problem with my snoring or throat or whatever it is, I don't need to go see an ENT.
Right.
And that could just see a decline in healthcare and in people's general health.
Yeah. I mean, and I just think that there's something contradictory here because, like, if Lieberman says that, like, taxes, small taxes really, change behavior, then he needs to pay attention, you know, when it comes to sugary drinks to improve their health, then he needs to pay attention to making people pay more on other health elements.
Right. I mean, you know, Lahav, I hear the criticism, but on the other hand, we haven't had a budget in 3 years, right? And I share that criticism with you, but, like, there's also good positive aspects and outcomes of this of the budget. One is an extra billion shekel to welfare services in this country, and that's Holocaust survivors, and that's healthier food clinics and things like that. I saw
an extra 2 billion to the health ministry.
An extra 2 billion to the health ministry.
We
needed it before the pandemic, where we had overcrowded hospitals, and we definitely need it now during the pandemic. And we're going to bring on Mayan Hoffman, our coronavirus analyst, to talk about the latest on Israel's coronavirus situation, which does not look so good. But the fact of the matter is that this government is managing to push forward a budget, which is something that Netanyahu didn't do for 3 years since 2018. And I got to say, there's a sense that this government is actually working on behalf of the state of Israel, on behalf of the people for now. I don't know how long it'll last. Let's see if they actually get the budget passed by. What do they have at the beginning of November? So we'll see if that actually works. But there is a good feeling, I think, that things are getting done. And
as much as I have criticisms of this budget, first of all, you're right. There are good things about it, and we can talk about them. But second of all, just the fact that we have a budget is very good for the budgetary situation and for the deficit and things like that. You know, we needed a budget, you know, and it has its pluses and minuses of this specific
and every budget always will, by the way.
Of course. Right.
It's always going to be a balance between what can you provide and what you can't provide, and where you got to cut and where you got to create revenue for the state to be able to provide services that you want to offset. You want to give more money to the health ministry? Okay. Where are you going to bring that money from?
Right. Well, one of the best things that I think this government is doing is a reform in the Israeli Standards Institute.
Yes.
Which is where, like, anything that's imported into Israel has to meet a specific Israeli standard. So, like, the EU standard or the American standard, both of which are quite strict, is not good enough in Israel. And then that raises the price of imports. So
and it takes time, and imports cost more. And now they're getting rid of that. If the Europeans approve it, it's good enough for us, right?
Yeah.
And if the Americans approve it, because, which, by the way, if you think about it from, that's how we've been with the vaccines, right? If the FDA said go for it, we started to do it.
Right.
Right. That was, suddenly we needed our own thing. Okay. You know, that's one of these anachronistic, I think, leftovers of old socialist Israel back in, like, probably the 50s, 60s, maybe the 70s. One other topic that I do want to touch on with you is Iran, right? We had that attack against the ship. We had a Romanian captain and a British security guard who were killed. We've seen the world pretty much align itself with Israel, which immediately blamed the Iranians for using a suicide drone to attack that ship because it had some partial ownership of an Israeli businessman. Boris Johnson made comments. Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State of the United States, made comments. The Romanians have made comments. They've called in the Iranian ambassador and condemned him. Or what do they call that? In diplomatic.
Demarche.
Yes, a demarche. Thank you. That's why you're our diplomatic correspondent.
Right. But that's also why I almost never use that word, because if you're not a diplomatic correspondent, you just don't know it.
You don't know. Yes. What can we really, I mean, there's two things that are happening, right? Lahav, there's the ship, which now we see everyone kind of aligned. We got to do something. We're going to make them pay a price. Benny Gantz said we'll do it when it's good for us. Blinken and Johnson are saying we're going to do something. So, A, what can they do really practically? And B, how is this going to impact Vienna talks, which are anyhow not happening at the moment? And we're hearing a lot of pessimism coming out of Washington about whether they will even succeed in doing something, in bringing a return to the JCPOA, that 2015 nuclear deal.
Well, okay, so there's different elements here. So first of all, we have Israel, which, first of all, going back to what we were saying about the budget, the defense budget is going to get a big hike this year, which a lot of people are relating to issues with Iran. And, you know, we've seen how Israel's responded. When Gantz spoke in the Knesset on Monday, he said that there have been 5 attacks on Israel-linked ships by Iran in the past year. And we've seen that Israel's responded with attacking Iranian ships a couple times with different kinds of cyber attacks.
The shadow maritime war.
The shadow maritime war, and also the shadow war on the nuclear program, which in many ways Israel's like barely hiding anymore. You know, they're not releasing press releases, but they're not like censoring us from reporting on it either, in many cases. So there's that. I imagine there'll be more of that. But when it comes to the US and the UK and the nuclear talks, to me, it just seems like, you know, they could say whatever they want about there being a forthcoming response, I believe was Blinken's word, and Johnson said there need to be consequences for Iran. But then Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, basically went up and said, the more criminal activity by Iran, the more important it is to return to the Iran deal so that we can supervise them and keep an eye on them. But what she didn't mention is that going back to the Iran deal means that the U.S. is going to lift all sanctions in Iran. I mean, the U.S. envoy for Iran, Rob Malley, has already said that that's what's on the table, all sanctions removed. And that's not even enough for Iran. They want.
But the Iranians aren't even there. They left after the 6th round of talks. They haven't come back. And we heard Malley say this to the New York Times. We at the Jerusalem Post spoke with a top State Department official who made similar comments of lots of pessimism. Even if the Iranians, they don't know where they are, right? They're gone. And we know that Raisi now is taking office this week. He's the new president. We don't yet know who his foreign minister is, who his nuclear negotiator is, whether he will even want to come back to those talks. He's been critical of Rouhani, the outgoing president. I don't even know if there will be a deal.
Quote by Abba Evan that the Arabs never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. So in this case, like, Iran is missing their opportunity to have all the sanctions lifted, right? Because the Americans are willing to just give it to them. And no matter what they say about there being consequences for bombing this ship, their leverage is sanctions, and they're willing to just give it up. And, like, basically what they're saying is we want a deal no matter what, almost. But yes, the Iranians, it seems, don't really want the deal. They say their excuse is that they don't trust that the Americans won't leave the deal.
And right, of course, like they did.
Right. And the Americans can't really guarantee they won't leave it because a current president can't bind a future president. The other thing the Iranians offered, according to the Wall Street Journal, was to only allow the Americans to leave it with approval from the UN, which is also would probably be unconstitutional to put America's foreign policy under somebody else.
So here's my suggestion, okay?
Yeah.
For what it's worth, Israel cannot solve the Iranian nuclear threat right now on our own. We have to see what's going to happen with the Biden administration, what the P5 plus one, which the U.S. is part of, is going to happen with the Iranian nuclear talks. But here's what Israel can do. Artyom Dolgopiat, who we started with, he can get married. And he needs to be able to get married in Israel, as do about 300,000 other Israelis who live in this country who are not Jewish according to halakha, to Orthodox interpretation of Jewish law. They should be allowed to get married because one of the basic rights in a democracy is the ability to get married. That's what Israel can do. That's what Bennett and Lapid and their government should pass. Let's hope they do that. We're joined now by Mayan Hoffman, head of strategy for the Jerusalem Post Group and the senior coronavirus analyst for the Jerusalem Post. Mayan, great to have you.
Thank you.
So Israel's numbers are out of control, no?
I mean, they doubled. You know, if you want to talk about new cases, we're starting to see a doubling rate of every couple of days at this point. We thought we were plateauing at around 2,000, and then we saw on Tuesday, you know, 4,000, and we don't know what we'll see tomorrow. We had some extra tests, you know, but it's, looks like it's going up and up.
What is this from? Why are our numbers so bad at the moment?
I mean, the Delta variant, it's worldwide. This isn't an Israel thing. This is a worldwide phenomenon. The Delta variant is extremely contagious, extremely infective. It has been a vaccine resistance and to some extent in terms of contagion with the Pfizer and Moderna, you know, mRNA vaccines. And certainly we know also with AstraZeneca, it's somewhat vaccine resistant, meaning that you can catch the virus. But it is important to remember that a lot of the people who are catching the virus that are vaccinated are not developing serious illness. The vaccines are working, but they're not working enough to prevent disease. And that's certainly the case if you were vaccinated, let's say, at the beginning of the vaccine campaign, December, January, February.
So, I mean, it seems that the real important number is how many are seriously ill, because, you know, you out of 4,000 people or however many who may have COVID, you could have only a few hundred who are actually sick.
100%. And that's a really good point. And unfortunately, what we're starting to see now is the serious numbers are going up. For a long time, it looked like the percentage was staying, you know, much lower with regards to the serious this time versus the last time. I would say first, second, and third wave even, you know, percentage of people infected developing serious illness. Unfortunately, that's starting to change. But again, that is mostly among unvaccinated people. It's not the most serious cases. The people who are dying are people who were vaccinated either a long time ago, have severe underlying medical conditions. All of the hospital directors are talking about that, or, you know, were unvaccinated.
So let's talk a moment about the Bennett government handling of the COVID crisis. And this is really, I think, for now, going to set the tone for whether he succeeds or does not succeed, at least for the foreseeable future. So there's a couple of things that's happened. One is his decision to start to distribute or give out the third jab or the booster shot to people over the age of 60. Israel's leading the world and taking that decision. There's the campaign that was launched this week, and everyone is, you know, I've spoken with people over the age of 60. They're getting reached out to from their medical health funds who are saying, let's set up an appointment. People are going. There's been a good response. That. So he's banking on hopefully that succeeding and keeping that high risk demographic and population in good condition and protected. But what he's also doing is, it seems to me, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but that Ben Gurion Airport has become vilified as like the enemy of the state of Israel. And the decision that everyone, there's a lot of populism involved here. That's how it seems to me. But there was a decision that was taken on Tuesday. Anyone who comes back from America goes into a week of quarantine. Anyone who comes back from Italy, Bulgaria, Greece, and a bunch of other countries.
Different countries now.
Half the world. Iceland, right? Lav, you were recently in Iceland. No?
Oh, really? Iceland's on the
list now?
Oh, man. Well, I came back in time.
Yeah, I was in the States. I came back in time, too. Is this right? I mean, is this what's going to succeed? This is the solution?
You know, I don't think the airport is his only solution, but I do think that a lot of infection comes in through the airport. And it's not even so much the people that are coming and flying in with infection. It's the fact that we have not yet managed to have proper enforcement, meaning that if somebody comes in and they're sick and they're not staying in isolation, right, then we have a real issue that they go around, they spread disease, or they're not taking their coronavirus test. So they are infected and they don't know it and they spread disease. So of course, you know, we have known, again, internationally, this isn't an Israel problem, that airports are a hotbed of infection. And it's not so much on the airplane, it's actually the airport itself. When people are gathering, you know, check in, check out, security, these kind of things, standing on top of each other in closed spaces.
Even the testing itself, like people are not keeping their distance in the test.
People aren't wearing masks here, though. I mean, let's also be honest. Inside, indoors, people are not wearing masks.
100%. And it's, you know, we are, we got complacent. And, you know, whether you want to say that it's the Israeli personality or you want to blame the way Netanyahu said the virus is over, whatever it is.
Yeah, let's blame Netanyahu.
We can blame whoever we want. But the truth of the matter is that Israelis are not following the rules. And we got very used to, you know, the country opening up and feeling very proud of that. And now people didn't want another wave to come in. We knew, health experts knew that variants would exist and there was a possibility that there would be a variant that would be like this Delta variant. But, you know, no one wanted that.
What about the issue of kids? I mean, there's a lot of talk about kids basically spreading the virus. If you're under 12, you can't be vaccinated. If you're under 6, you don't wear a mask. And most of them are asymptomatic.
Correct. But I also think that this is really actually quite controversial. And this is something that I think, you know, I don't think we have yet the right policy in place. And I'm not sure when we get to it. But also, there's a lot of research that shows that kids don't spread the virus in general, certainly younger kids, right? So if you're talking about 3 and 4 and 5 year olds, they tend to, even if they catch corona, and they are asymptomatic, as you noted, they are much less likely to actually infect other people.
Yeah, I can actually tell you my kids are 2 and 4. And last week, they were in quarantine the whole week because they each in their separate preschools had a kid who had COVID in their class. So,
I'm just glad
it happened to both of them at the same time and I didn't have to like be with quarantine kids separately. But in both cases, no one else in the entire class had COVID.
Right. It's very normal. And they actually, you know, at the end of the last wave, what they did do was they started to look into whether or not infection had actually spread in elementary schools. Now, again, in middle and high schools, it does spread, right? So we do want people over the age of 12 to get vaccinated because they have a very strong chance of spreading the virus. But they found that in the elementary schools, just like in the preschools, it wasn't really spreading. So why are we not going to let kids, you know, go into events? I'm not sure that that's necessarily the right policy. I'm not one to make policy, but I think sometimes these black and white policy, we tend to take sweeping movements without necessarily, I mean, making a decision to give the third jab, for example, as you brought up, Yaakov, we are the first in the world. Now, on the one hand, you could say, wow, we're the first in the world. You know, we're such a, so groundbreaking. On the other hand, you know, other countries are following suit now.
Well, we were also the first in the world to vaccinate. So if it weakens over time, then it would make sense that we get the third dose first.
But we are doing it without FDA approval. And we did not give any vaccines in this country in the first round without FDA approval.
I didn't want to say that we're being guinea pigs, but to an extent, there's an experiment being done here on Israeli elderly, and we'll see if it works or not.
Right. I mean, and I think, you know, there's the beginnings of good research on this, but we don't really know. But there's, you know, many health professionals have expressed the reality is we also don't know what will happen if all of these older people whose vaccine is not effective anymore get sick with corona. And so, you know, there is two sides to that coin, and that's why we're seeing other countries starting to follow suit. But there isn't data. There's not enough data. And, you know, in corona in general, this is a new pandemic for us. Even after a year and a half, there are things we know and there are things we don't know. And so we have to make some decisions on the fly.
The Bennett doctrine of what is it, live alongside the pandemic.
100% correct.
Right. Is that possible?
It has to be. The pandemic is not going away. What people have to realize is that coronavirus is probably with us in perpetuity. Think of the flu. Think of hepatitis. There's a lot of viruses, right, that have come in. We've developed vaccines for them. We vaccinate regularly. Sometimes, you know, childhood vaccination takes care of it. But when a lot of there's a history of viruses and other diseases entering the world, and we have to learn to live with them. So I think that in that sense, Bennett and his, you know, and his government are trying, whether successfully or not, is a whole other question, but trying to, you know, the line of live alongside the coronavirus is exactly the line that has to be said. But that means that if we need masks, people have to wear the masks. Living alongside the coronavirus doesn't mean everything's open up and we do everything like we used to. We have to change our lives in order to do that.
So in the UK, they had like very, very bad situation with the Delta variant. And yet they still, about 2 weeks ago, declared Freedom Day, where they like opened everything up. But I think it was sort of like you said, I think that they still have mask mandates and things like that. I'm not sure of all the details. And the charts that I've seen showed that the Delta variant sort of topped off and the numbers are slightly starting to go down there. That's so correct. Do Israelis think that that's what's going to happen here?
Well, you know, if you talk to Professor Eran Segal, that is his whole premise. And he's, you know, the computational biologist from the Weizmann Institute that's been advising the government. And he believes that that without question, we're going to follow the UK line, which means that the cases will go up and up. The series will follow suit, but slightly lower percentage from what we, you know, saw in the previous week. Waves, and eventually we plateau and then we start to go down. So it's very possible.
How does that work though? Aren't we vaccinated at a higher rate than the UK?
No, actually we're not vaccinated at a higher rate than the UK. The UK has about 85% of their adult population also vaccinated at this point. We just vaccinated faster. Now, one of the reasons that they might be seeing that differently then is because remember our older population vaccinated first, vaccinated 6 months ago, and theirs vaccinated 3 months ago, which means those vaccines are stronger still.
The antibodies are stronger.
The antibodies are stronger. Yeah.
So the bottom line is that besides for not being able to plan trips, so Lahav and I got lucky with the window that we took our vacations over the summer. But besides not being able to really plan trips, what else should we expect in terms of disruption? Right? One of the other things that's being spoken about is if you are a vaccinated individual, but you come into contact now with someone who's sick, you will require quarantine, which is going back to the pre-vaccination stage. Right? One of the benefits of being vaccinated was no more quarantine.
Right. It's under discussion, exactly, in that you'd have to test and show that you're negative. I don't think that's wrong, because we know that unvaccinated people are actually spreading the virus to vaccinated people at this point, and then that vaccinated person could spread the virus. Of course, people who are vaccinated tend to have a lower viral load and spread less. So, you know, you might be in quarantine for less time. It depends what, you know, rules they end up putting in place. At the same time, you know, there are talking about potentially needing to do some form of a lockdown, likely over Rosh Hashanah. I will tell you, and from my perspective, now I'm putting this out there on a podcast and maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I think we are going to lock down on Rosh Hashanah. It will be a tight lockdown, but it'll have minimal impact on the economy because it's 9 real working days within that month. And that will help to quickly lower the virus. And then we'll be able to open up right after.
You're not saying just Rosh Hashanah. Then what you're talking about
the
is
holidays.
The holidays, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot?
I think for most of it, because right. I think that what we're seeing now is that people are not able to follow these basic rules. And as a result, the infection rate is still going up and up. And even though in the UK on the 19th, they did reduce, they did open up and they did let people go out.
Maybe that's about just letting people live their lives. And there is going to be a cost for that.
There is. And people have to learn at some point that they need to take personal responsibility for themselves. And, you know, wear your mask when you walk around and
get vaccinated.
Get vaccinated. Wash your hands. You know, basic things like that. You know,
and basic hygiene.
Yeah. And that should hopefully
help. And if you're older, then stay out of crowds.
Right. And, you know, think about that. I mean, the truth of the matter is maybe we do need a house anyway. Smaller gatherings. Not everything needs to run exactly like it did before.
Well, I can say that and you had a sister who got married during COVID. I had a brother who got married during COVID. And when I got married 19 years ago, we had hundreds and hundreds of people at our wedding. I don't even think I knew any of them. But when my brother got married, there were like 40 people there, and it was beautiful. Right. So maybe there's even benefit, cost less. That's
right,
for sure.
There's definitely something to it. My stepson is actually having his bar mitzvah like 2 days before Rosh Hashanah, that Friday before. And I last night said to my husband, oh, great. Make sure that they know there probably won't be a kiddush. You know, so,
you know, the thing is, I agree that people need to take personal responsibility, but it also, and this goes back to what we were discussing with the budget, that there are a lot of people who are less privileged than we are and that their jobs are sort of very client facing and they just can't work from home if they need to. You know, the cashier at the supermarket is just constantly going to be exposed to lots and lots of people. And I think that we need to take responsibility also for people like that.
100%. And I mean, again, that's also personal responsibility and, you know, unity by going to the grocery store and wear your mask and, you know, be careful when you're doing these things. Those are essential workers, the people who work in all the stores that operate for us, and they have been in all the waves, and we should take care of them.
It's tough, but we'll see how Israel plays out. Well, Mayan, thank you for joining us, giving us the update on what's happening here with COVID, and hopefully things will improve.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us in this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. We look forward to seeing you next week.